Our talk this morning will be given by Senior Dharma Teacher Diane Fitzgerald.
And so during this Angho, we have an opportunity to explore and hear from people about koans that they find especially meaningful or their favorites. And the case I'm going to talk about today from the Blue Cliff Record is definitely one of my favorites, if not my very favorite. And it is about the Bodhisattva of Compassion, Avalokiteshvara. And throughout our retreat, we call out her name and invoke her presence so often during the day. When we chant the Harp Sutra, that's Avalokiteshvara talking to Shariputra. And when we chant Kanzeon, there's the Japanese version of the Bodhisattva of Compassion. And when we practiced yesterday afternoon our Om Nam chant, Kanan Doku, calling out Om and listening for the response. And so Guanyin, the Chinese name, we call to her in the dedication when we're lost in the dark and broken roads. And so this Bodhisattva, it's can be male or female. I call her she because I think some of her later depictions are female, but also male. And she is someone who hears the cries of the world. And so she's one of the Buddhist stories is that she was a Bodhisattva who said that she would not enter Nirvana until she had saved all beings. And she just heard so many cries from the world that she couldn't handle it. And Buddha, Amitabha Buddha, split her head into 11 so that she would have enough ears to hear all the cries. And then she didn't have enough arms to help all the people. And so Amitabha Buddha gave her 11 arms. And in our kind of Japanese heritage, we often hear about her depicted as having arms and eyes all over, maybe 80,000 arms, 80,000 eyes all over, to hear our cry when we call out to her. And I can hardly talk about it without crying myself, but I'll try to. So this is the case. Case 89, the hands and eyes of the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion. Yan Yan asked Dawu, "What does the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion use so many hands and eyes for?" Wu said, "It's like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the middle of the night." Yan said, "I understand." Wu said, "How do you understand it?" Yan said, "All over the body are hands and eyes." Wu said, "You have said quite a bit there, but you've only said 80% of it." Yan said, "What do you say, elder brother?" Wu said, "Throughout the body are hands and eyes." And this case is also interesting to me because Yan Yan and Dao Wu, they are fellow students. So often our cases are the monk talking to the master or the teacher, but here are fellow students talking to each other. And, you know, there are students who are seriously on the path, but they are talking to each other in, I think, in kind of a playful way, and in kind of great sincerity of practice about this is what really matters to us, and how can we engage with each other as we both travel this path with our teacher. And so the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion, with her so many hands and eyes. It's like someone reaching for a pillow in the night. And it reminds me of the beautiful case that Melissa talked about yesterday, where the teacher, speaking to his students, said, you know, I have a dream, you know, would you like to interpret my dream? What is your interpretation going to be? And their response was so simple and so direct. And one offered the teacher the bowl of water and the towel, and the other offered the bowl of tea. And when I heard that case, to me the dream wasn't really the teacher asking about an actual dream. It was the teacher asking about his life and his teaching, and what do you students make of this? You know, how have you heard what I've told you? And so lovely that they were able to respond with their whole being and in such a direct and beautiful way. And so here we have the Bodhisattva of Compassion, and one student saying to a fellow student, you know, what do you make of this in this world we live in that's so on fire? And so often we do find ourselves in the dark and broken roads, and what do we do? Who do we call to? Why does the Bodhisattva of Compassion have all of these hands and eyes? And one student so clearly cuts through and says, it's just like reaching for the pillow in the night. Something that we all know exactly what that means. Not one of us. And this case being written in the 12th century, here almost 1,000 years later, still able to communicate that very direct, simple response. Where is Guanyin? The pillow in the night, the sun shining through the window, the wind in the trees, always available to us, never far. Sometimes we feel like we are so isolated, and we're not. Guanyin is always there, and it's not some idea we have of some being that we call out to in some other place, somewhere separate from us. It is us calling out to us, and always right here we have her presence. And then you see the students talking back and forth with each other, saying, how do you understand it? And one saying, I understand. And getting into a little bit of a back and forth here about, but you've only said 80% of it. And can you feel like the mind kind of going down that road of, oh, this is confusing, you know, what are they talking about? And there is, and that arises for us, not just with koans, but in our daily encounters, so much confusion. And we can feel ourselves getting drawn into that, always trying to, how can we figure this out, you know? How can we make this work? How can we make it right? And that is, you know, there is a way of responding that is other, which is what this case is pointing to, which is the simple reaching for the pillow that we all know and that brings us home to who we really are. Always Guanyin with us, everywhere in the universe, in our own hearts too. Thank you.
No.
just invite people to speak.
Oh, thank you. So now is time for our Dharma dialogue, and our petition is to sit comfortably if you like, and feel free to offer any comments, questions, what's in your heart.
Well, I've been praying to Guan Yin for a very long time, and she has gotten me through some really, really difficult times. And there was one time, I thought I was going to die, and I was saying her name over and over again, even when I was sleeping. You know, and I'd wake up and I would be saying her name. But whenever I connect to her energy, either as Avalokiteshvara or Guan Yin, or, you know, it moves me to tears. So whenever I move to tears, that's when I connect her energy.
Yeah. I can feel that too.
No, really.
Yeah.
You know, like there was one time, there was a Tibetan Zen mandala with the Buddha of Compassion. And when I was praying, I was really connected to energy. The tears would just start flowing and I couldn't stop it.
Yeah. Thank you.
I can see the 80,000 arms. Thank you for taking care of us. And thank you, Steve.
And you too. We would start. Yeah. Sangha, all taking care of each other.
And I think these tears, I'm just really, so sitting here as you're giving the talk, my heart opens, our heart opens when we touch this energy. And I know for myself, sometimes I want to look, well, what do the tears mean? Like, but there, it feels like there's some fullness of presence of the heart, and the tears, it's almost like there's no need to understand or why is it from, but there is the broken heart, the open heart of the world, that I guess for so long I thought that's the problem. Right, the tears are the problem. How can I, if Kanzeon comes, then the tears will go away. But but this possibility that you were saying, Diane, that the calling out, the tears itself are this immediate response.
I know that Diane just started doing hospice work, and I used to do a lot of hospice work, so we've been talking about this. And one of the things I've always said, the reason I was attracted to it, is the same reason I'm attracted to Zen practice, because there's a certain way that everybody's being so brave and pretending that everything is fine. You know, you ask, how are you? And everybody says, fine. And these are like broken-hearted people saying, fine, fine, fine. But in hospice, nobody says that, you know, because they're not fine. They're fine in some huge, darn, you know, large sense. But people are much more open with their tears and struggling. And I always find that a great relief. Like, I felt really, I didn't sob when you were talking. I thought you guys were. but I actually just felt this incredible sense of ease and openness. That I identify with a kind of dropping away of the masks and the, you know, fine, I'm fine, I'm fine, everything's fine. You know, just sort of melting. That I also associate with Zen practice. You know, it's what I'm not as interested in people who show up as, you know, fine, as, and then, not to pretend, because sometimes we are fine. So don't think you're going to come in sobbing and I'll give you some kind of pass. But to come in genuinely, like really genuinely, to be genuine. And when we really evoke the spirit of Guanyin, the heart just opens. You can't help it. And so tears are one way to express that. So I'm just really grateful that you've she's been here the whole time.
But it's Ted Kelpus.
just that little sparrow wiping it away. But still, to evoke her is important. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I guess the part that always hits me about that particular koan is the focus on giving yourself comfort. It's that you're reaching back to adjust the pillow. And in some ways, it feels easier to open to Guanyin out there, to cry, to feel grateful, to feel her compassion towards us than it is in the same way to recognize that as something we give ourselves or can give ourselves or that it is part of us. And I always struggle with that difference, that it's so much easier to pray to or feel open to Guanyin than to me actually doing the comforting of me.
I never looked at it that way before, so thank you.
Well, and then when we do that without thinking, who is it that's adjusting the pillow? You know, that wasn't my plan when I went to bed. Adjust pillow at 2:30 in the morning. But this idea that, you know, I think we can make self-compassion our new project that we're going to be good at. All right, I'm really going to work hard at self-compassion. But I think you're speaking to this sort of naturally arising, you know, and I think a lot of us identify with being hard on ourselves. And that's true, but there's this other natural, inborn part of us that maybe we can learn to trust more.
You know, and I think that natural, inborn part kind of gets blocked by all our ideas about what we're supposed to do. So that natural, inborn self-care can get blocked by trying to be self-compassionate. You know, there's even a curriculum now, an 8-week course in becoming self-compassionate. And, oh man, I shouldn't say anymore. But this natural thing, that it just happens if we get out of our own way. I think that's what I hear you pointing to, Carolyn. I've been, for a little while, I was wearing gloves at night to help moisturize my hands because they were all cracked. And in the morning I would wake up and they would be sitting on my bedside table. Well, who did that? And I immediately thought it was Cohen. It wasn't David. David didn't pull them. I'm pretty sure. But wow, you know, this is we don't have to be in charge of everything. It's such a great relief. It's a relief. It's a relief.
So nice to see you.
What thank you for your talk. And it's just like I showed up like 10 minutes ago or something. I entered into 80 kalpas.
So many years ago that I can't remember, I think when I first started to practice, I acquired this beautiful little alabaster statue of Guan Yin. And I don't know how she survived all these years with me because she went through everything that I went through. I would stare at that statue at the worst points in my life without comprehending anything, and I couldn't get rid of her. It's like I never found a reason to lose her, and she was always there, and she never moved, and she was constantly sitting holding the jewel in her lap. And she's so beautiful, and there were times I thought, oh, what am I going to do with that? But she was always there in that form. When I was at my worst, when I was at my best, when I was in between, just constantly. And she's still there. She's at home. She's waiting when I go back this evening.
So So kind of going in the opposite direction of the you know, the automatic self-comforting of adjusting the pillow. So Laura and I have several different statues of Kuan Yin scattered about the house. And it's funny that it's so important to me, in, given that on an intellectual level, I have great difficulty with the idea of like a magical being that I'm calling on to fix things. Mm-hmm. And also the duality of it, you know, that I'm calling out to this other being, you know, that, that's going to respond to me and do something. And yet on a personal level, I think it's so, so important to, for me, to be able to call out when I am, when I'm lost and broken and just utterly unable to help myself in any way, to simply be able to, you know, just please, please help me, you know, and this calling out, this surrendering to my own helplessness and inability to comfort myself or anyone else, and just to plead for for help. It's just such an opening thing, you know, to just be able to open up and admit defeat and cry you know, I don't like to think of it as a magical thing exactly, but there's this wonderful you know, opening, this, you know, breaking of the heart and breaking open and things becoming so so real and intimate in that moment of allowing our hearts to break. No, it's difficult to understand intellectually, and yet, you know, it's so obvious to me on another level, you know, that it's very important. So.
And to me, it's not magical, except in the way of the great miracles we talked about, you know, the, what were some of them? Not the fire coming out of your head, but just the great miracles of
that. That was the small miracle. Well,
yeah, chopping wood,
carrying water,
yeah.
Bringing that basin of water.
Yeah. That kind of magical, yeah. Mm. Always right there.
It seems fortuitous that you, the talk today was about compassion and the bodhisattva of compassion, because when we chanted the vows, I was really struggling with vowing to save all beings. I can't save myself, so I can't imagine saving all beings, and to vow such a thing is a serious matter, it seems. So, but perhaps that's where you call out and acknowledge that you need the help of the universe, and I'd be interested if you have any further comment in that connection.
I'm just so struck by your humility in not wanting to take a vow that you're not sure you can keep, because what occurred to me was, I chant that all the time and I don't have that same, like, you approached it so freshly, like, this is a vow to save all beings, I don't know I can do that. That's so lovely. So, you know.
You know, seeing it or hearing it anew.
Yeah.
Because I've said that many times in the past, and mm-hmm. daunting today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so right there for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, in the first Zen group that we were all part of for a while, the translation of that first vow was "all beings, one body, I vow to liberate," which I thought was really cool because it points to the same teaching that we're all circling around. You know, who's doing what? <You know? Yeah. laughs> Wait a minute. I thought it was me. And so, and who's doing what to whom? And how is this all working? And so, for me, I know that, you know, I feel like I'm making a contribution sometimes when what I do, thinking I'm being helpful, isn't harming. That's a whole other conversation. So I always go back to this analogy that if I was in charge of my own body, like I had to beat my own heart and make my liver function and make my kidneys function, I'd be dead within a couple of seconds. It's just, I can't do that. And so to think of the whole world as my body, like I am not in charge of this. But I can contribute it, and then I can appreciate it. Like, who moved the pillow? Who took the gloves off? You know, who am I? What is this? Those are, for me, the two central koan questions. And so everything where we get this little, oh, what is it? I vow to save all beings as a koan. And no way to solve it right now, but to just feel that, the wow quality to it. Yeah. I appreciate it too.
And I think of the how we mistake ourselves for the one who can do it. Mm. Right. All right, Zen practice. Just, you know, what are the rules here? And how important it is to, I guess, going back to what Steve was saying, so we can't do this. You know, and any idea we have about how to do it, it is not it. And so then the vow is not about, I'm going to work really hard and make this happen, but for me, much more touching with that heart wish or this longing that my life be of use. You know, I hope, right? My deepest hope. And I don't know how to do that. But nevertheless, I'll start in that direction.
Compassion is at work in the universe, and perhaps I can cooperate with it in certain places and times.
Yeah.
But I have found that the harder I try, the more I screw up.
Yeah, and yet if we don't have some intention, then we screw up too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, and this is really why we have figures of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas around.
Mm.
Not because we believe in mystical beings per se. You know, you don't have to believe in that. But that there are these forces in the universe. Mm-hmm. And the human minds are very limited. And we forget about this stuff. So these are reminders. There's embodiments, and every religion in the world has them. Embodiments of compassion, of wisdom, of surrender, you know, they're generous activity. They're all in every religion. Some of them have more than others. Like Hindus have the most, I think. And, you know, Buddhists have a lot, especially Mahayana Buddhists, which is what we are. So it's not like, you know, like when I look at the stuffed Buddha with the little stuffed Buddha up above me. it's like, you know, most of the time I don't even see it. But every once in a while, like, wow, that's an embodiment of kind of playful happiness. Okay, thank you. So I'll bow to that and remember that it's possible in the universe. And, you know, same thing with the Buddha on the altar and the Buddha outside and all of these guys and women. They're just forms for something that we forget, so we need to be reminded.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So I know Chris had his hand up and then like.
Steered away a little bit.
Bring us back.
Oh, just from what I was going to say. I encounter in my work as a clergy person folk who can't bring themselves to pray because the only sense of what prayer means is asking some being outside for a magical fix. And it's like, if that was what it all hinged on, we would have all given that up a long time ago, because that almost never happens. And when there is the miracle cure, I'm not sure it had anything to do with anybody's prayer. And it's like, that, you know, it's about a presence. It's about something like when you just let yourself be, as you said, Steve, in that kind of helpless place. What spirit or mind that is already present or even within you are you kind of opening to? Like, no, God's not going to take away cancer. It's too late for that. But some spirit of love can be with you and your family while you're in the middle of this thing. And, you know, I think of, like, in 12-step programs, you know, it's like your prayer will be answered, but rarely in the way you think it's going to be, right? Like, and that's the rub. What do you, little Chris, think is the fix? You know, that's never happened. You know, so that what we're asking for is something different, which is like a state of mind or a spirit for dealing with what actually is, and that, when called upon, I can testify comes.
Yeah, and I think that it reminds me that this kanandoku, this call and response we do with Om Nam, is from this practice that George Bowman, my teacher, passed on to me, which was to call out to the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Kuan Yin, and I'd always been good at calling out, but he suggested that maybe there is a possibility of receiving something. And that hadn't ever occurred to me. So I could spend all my time calling out and calling out and calling out and then calling out some more.
Right.
And this possibility then of receiving what appears as the answer. Because I'm much more like, well, that's not the answer I wanted. So if I wait for the answer I want, it's going to be a long time. But this receiving what appears as the answer, and then part of this call and response is being receptive, opening, to, as you say, to this presence that's here.
Also, we think it's going to happen like that, right? Like, okay, finally I'm going to pray, and I'm going to pray right now. What? No instant response? And it's sort of like,
that's
well,
proof.
It is the first time, you know, you did just start opening your heart in this way. And maybe I've been all through this talk thinking of the line in the Sutra Service that says when we put these things out there, they are subtly heard and responded to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you might not realize that until 35 years from now.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's pointing to a thought that I had when you were talking, and again, it's the way the human brain is constructed. We don't have the capacity to know everything. So we don't actually know why a certain outcome happens. And it could be that praying actually does contribute to it, but probably every single thing that exists contributes to whatever the outcome is. And we can only... What is it? You read some research that in every moment there are 8 billion bits of information available to the senses, and we can only be aware of 8. You know, so we think, you know, I know what's going on. But there's... 8 billion minus 8 bits. Then that's just in a moment. You know, this isn't Mahayana teaching. This is some brain scientist figured this out. So that it's humbling. And then the other piece of this, of course, is that we make a big deal out of surrendering. And not surrendering as resignation, but surrendering as opening. You know, like when we lift our arms up, when we do our prostrations. This, here it is.
So just sitting here listening and feeling my heart kind of flutter away, because I feel like I have something I want to say, but it's hard to speak. The part that you talked about, when you talked about the case, and Melissa, you've just been speaking to it, is the 80%. I love that. I love that line. It's you've got 80% of it. It's like funny. I mean, how lucky would it be to have that much of it? 8 billionths.
Yeah, right.
But I think that that's a beautiful moment where he turns and he says, "Well, how would you say it? How would you say it, sister? How would you say it, brother?" So for me, that moment of like, you know, where he's at when he says, "Well, how would you say it?" is really intriguing. I love that moment. In the case, he's maybe he is confused. Maybe at that moment he's saying, "What do you, you know, like, what do you mean?" Maybe he's like defensive. Maybe, "Well, what would you say?" or maybe he's like really open-hearted and like, you know, "Who are you in this moment with me?" So many ways to hear it. But I find that to be a powerful moment of whether it's confusion or love or what. But they're different. They're different from each other. And I think that's a powerful point in the case, is that one of them says it one way and another says it a different way. They don't say it the same way. One of them says, "You know, well, it's like there's hand all over my body, there's eyes, you know." And the other says, "No, that's not quite it. They're actually through the body, you know." And I love that they're both 80% or 8 billionths or whatever it is, that, and that's complete, that's enough, that's... So like so often, I guess what this gets to for me is that so often I feel deficient. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, my love isn't big enough or good enough, you know, because it's filled with grief and longing and desire and sadness. And so this is not the right kind of love. Like my love is this broken love that mm-hmm. shows up. And, you know, I ought to have the love that shows up that's just... lights shine. But that's not how I show up. It's just not, you know. So the love that I feel, well, it comes in many forms, but, you know, right now the love that I feel is very tender, and so this is how I'm showing up, and it's like, well, that's not quite good enough, that's 80%. And that's, even that, it's not quite good enough, it's only 80%. Wow, right there, is... showing up completely. Anyway, I think it's a very beautiful case, and thank you for bringing it up.
Thank you for talking more about that part of it. So that is a really equally beautiful part of the case. So your presentation was 80% awesome.
I think everybody gets an 80% today.
Be quiet.
Eight, don't worry. Shouldn't say that to a teacher.
So graduate with a B minus.
Well, let's take a few more breaths. So.